Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Love music? Love interviews with lovely musicians? Search Virgin Radio UK on YouTube to find brilliant album specials with some of the shiniest lights on our playlist, including George Ezra.
It won't be like this forever, so just enjoy it while it's here. It's a really wonderful thing.
And James Bay.
It's about me. It's about my relationship with Lucy. It sums up so much of what went into writing this whole album. We're all works in progress. I still don't necessarily know who I am.
And Depeche Mode's Dave Gahan remembering the late, great Andy Fletcher.
I'll be honest with you, the first thought that came in my head was, I wish I'd been a bit kinder.
Watch all that and more at youtube.com/Virgin Radio UK.
It's Clever Person time! Another clever person has deigned to come into our studio here on the 17th floor. Who might it be this time, Vassos?
He is the best-selling author who's won the Pulitzer Prize, who's written a book which could win you all the conversations, except what he'll teach you is that's not the point. Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection is out now. So listen up, everyone, as we go big and Charles Duhigg.
All right, Charles, good morning.
This is the best introduction I've ever gotten
good.
In my life.
Excellent. That's how we like to roll here. You often learn more from a book from its last paragraph than its first. Here's Charles's last paragraph of this new book, Super Communicators. What's important is wanting to connect, wanting to understand someone, wanting to have a deep conversation, even when it's hard and scary or when it would be so much easier to walk away. There are skills and insights that can help us satisfy that desire for connection, and they're worth learning, practicing and committing to, because whether we call it love or friendship or simply having a great conversation, achieving connection, authentic, meaningful connection is the most important thing in life. What a paragraph! Control room round of applause for that single paragraph. Let's hear it. Come on. Yeah! I mean, come on. Last paragraph.
Last paragraph. Last paragraph.
Wow.
You guys know how to make a guy feel amazing.
That's our job. We want you firing on all cylinders. Of course, you have won the Pulitzer Prize. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. I know. Unbelievable. Charles, just tell us briefly. Give us the headlines of your Pulitzer Prize winning efforts, please, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So I was a reporter for the New York Times,
yep.
And we wrote about Apple, particularly working conditions in Chinese factories, making iPads and iPhones, and how Apple uses tax laws to avoid paying taxes. And so it was like looking at the international economy through Apple.
Right. And so you win the Pulitzer Prize. Do you get a whisper that you might win it or be nominated for it, like the Nobel Prize? Because apparently you get the whisper there.
No. You basically, what happens is that 2 days before they make it public, they tell all the editors. And until that moment, you have no idea what's going on.
Right.
And then you have 2 days to write a speech where you thank every single human being you could possibly think of, knowing that you're going to forget about half of them.
Oh, my gosh. And where does it happen? Is it a dinner? Is it a lunchtime or...?
No, yeah, it's actually, it's much less fancy than you would think. We do, at the Times, we would do this kind of announcement. The whole newsroom would come together, and then you go to a dinner where nobody's allowed to give any speeches.
Good.
And I brought my mom.
Oh,
and
nice.
Yeah, they hand you a chunk of glass and then say, good luck. Now you need to go back to work.
Yeah, where is your Pulitzer Prize now?
It's in my library. I sometimes use it. It's very sharp at the top, so sometimes I use it to open the mail.
Nice.
Nobody has any idea what it is, which is great.
What year was that?
That was 2013.
2013.
Same year that I wrote The Power of Habits.
Right. So I thought The Power of Habits came out 2012, 2013. So, I mean, you know, what a purple patch you were going through there. What were you drinking? What were you eating? How many hours were you sleeping?
Not many.
Wow. And then in 2017, you do talk on Rich's show. Rich is a big friend of the show, so everybody knows who I'm talking about, Rich Roll's podcast. You talked about not so much bottoming out, but there's a bit of meltdown going on around 2017.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you know, and you talked, I heard you mention about the fact you were having trouble managing people, and I thought You became a manager. If I won the Pulitzer Prize, I'd just go on my Pulitzer Prize world tour and just take applause for a year. That's what I would do. What happened?
Well, instead of taking my world tour, which would have been a lot more fun, they asked me to become a manager. And I have an MBA from Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. I've had managers through my entire life. When they asked me to become a manager, I thought, oh, I'm going to be amazing at this, right? I'm a professional communicator. I know how to do this.
Yes.
And I was okay at like the logistics part and the strategy part. And terrible at the communication part, just miserable at it. And the same thing would happen at home, where like I would come home from work, and tell me if this is similar in your guys' life. Come home from work after a long day, I would complain to my wife. She'd give me some good advice, like take your boss out to lunch and get to know each other.
Yeah.
And instead of listening to her good advice, I would get even more upset. And I'd be like, no, you're supposed to be on my side. You're supposed to be outraged on my behalf. And then she would get upset because I was yelling at her for giving me good advice.
Yeah.
And that's what was the genesis of Super Communicators. I wanted to figure out what I was doing
wrong.
So
it's me-search. You did some me-search.
Me-search, yes.
Research, research.
Yeah.
All these nonfiction books are written for the author, by the author, first and foremost. And they're the best ones.
They're the best ones because we're genuinely passionate and desperate to find an answer, right?
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
and you talk about your wife a lot. And you talk about what, you know, a lot of the book is what are all conversations really about?
That's right.
And, you know, can they be about different things? Because it's not about the words. It's about the backstory. It's about the energy. It's about various situations and positions that people find themselves in, whether it's chronological, geographical, or from an employment issue or a psychological issue. And I was thinking about this yesterday about, because you had this exchange with your wife about money, didn't you?
Yeah.
Just can you just speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were at this, we were in Florida at a spa, like this health resort, and we started talking about money. And we just started, we started having this screaming fight in the hallways of the spa. Literally, there's massage rooms right next to us. And we're like screaming at each other, which is not what you're supposed to do.
It's spa-like.
It's not what you're supposed to do at a spa. And to explain what happened, it's worth talking a little bit about what we've learned in the last decade about the science of communication. What we've learned mostly from neurology and our understanding has been transformed is that we tend to think of conversations being about one thing, right? We're arguing about money. We're talking about my day. But actually, every discussion is made up of multiple kinds of conversations. And they tend to fall into one of three buckets. So there's these practical conversations where we solve problems. There's emotional conversations where I tell you what I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations, which is how we relate to each other and our social identities. And when my wife and I were screaming at each other about money, what was happening is I was having a practical conversation. I was saying, we're spending too much. We need a budget. But Liz was having an emotional conversation. She was saying, I like feel attacked. I feel like you're blaming me for us spending this much. And I don't think that's fair. And because we weren't having the same kind of conversation with each other, all we did was antagonize each other.
And there's so much going on in your head there, isn't it? Because you're projecting your fears onto her.
Right.
You're projecting your tacit insecurity about maybe not being able to sustain the career to fund that bank account.
Exactly.
It's all going on and she's getting the brunt of it. Not the brunt of it. She's getting all of it.
All of it.
You're literally emptying this bowl of doo-doo on her head.
Yeah.
And it got me to thinking about my wife and our conversations. We argue a lot less than we used to. And is that because we've solved more problems or because we're just more respectful of each other? And I wrote it down. It's written down on one of the pages of your book here in front of me. I think that basically every time Tash and I have any kind of exchange, it's a do you still love me conversation.
Yeah.
Do you love me? Do you see me? Can you hear me? And have you got my back? And I think basically all our conversations are about that. And I was going through the different conversations we'd had, the important ones over the last 7 days about one of our children and then to do with running. And then there was another one to do with the situation, you know, I'm facing at the moment. And I thought, actually, they're just all, we're just checking if we've got each other's back the whole time.
And doesn't it feel wonderful? If in fact you know that you have each other's back, if in fact you say, we reaffirmed we love each other, then you can move on to this hard conversation,
totally.
Right? Because you're aligned. And we know this actually happens in our brain, that when we're in a conversation, our neural activity becomes more and more similar. We become what's known as neurally entrained. And when we're neurally entrained, like we are right now, then you can bring up a hard topic.
Yeah.
You can say, look, instead of, I want to have a practical conversation now. We need to figure out a solution here. And the other person comes with you on that journey to have the same kind of conversation. But it feels so important.
We see, it feels harmonic as well.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like you're in the same river, floating to the same place, and it's all good. You know, it'll be all right. It will be all right. Talking to Charles Duhigg about super communicators, so many great stories in the book. Where do we go to first? Do we go to the spy story first? Or do we go to the Big Bang Theory story first? Or do we go to the Netflix story first? I'm going to go straight in with Big Bang Theory.
I love it.
Yeah, and by the way, this is the Big Bang Theory, the TV show. You may think, what's that got to do with communicating? Well, because the writers faced a particular problem which speaks to how all of us can learn.
That's exactly right. And I think underlying this is one lesson that people should hear, which is the things we're talking about that make someone a super communicator, you are not born with these things,
yeah.
Right? They're things that you learn. They're just a set of skills.
Yes.
They're skills that anyone can learn. Any of us can become a super communicator. And so what happened with the Big Bang Theory, the TV show, is when the writers first came up with this idea, they realized it's a great idea. And the humor comes from the fact that all the characters have such trouble communicating with each other, particularly communicating emotionally, right? They all get in their own way. They're awkward. The problem is, though, when you're making a show, a sitcom, if you have characters who are bewildered and the audience doesn't know what to make of them, yeah. They don't like them.
Because they can't care about them.
Because they can't care about them.
Or they can't not care about them.
That's or if they're fighting with someone, they want to know if they're fighting because they actually dislike each other,
yeah.
Or they're fighting because they're secretly in love,
yeah.
And they're fighting. Right? We've all seen this on TV shows. And so they try attempt after attempt, and they actually make a pilot. It's a flop. Audiences hate it.
Yeah.
And then they realize that the way that they can get these characters to show that they're connected to each other without having to use their words is if they match each other's energy.
Yeah.
So if I come in and I'm big and energetic and I say, do you want a pizza to eat tonight? And you come in and
yes, I do, Charles.
Or, yeah, exactly. Or even if you say, no, I don't.
Yeah.
Then the audience knows that we like each other, right? We're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, we are.
And then it doesn't matter what we're saying. Yes. We can make joke after joke.
Uh-huh.
And so that was the thing. And that Big Bang Theory became the most popular TV show in history.
The longest running sitcom in history. It went from 9 million to 15 million to 20 million. And the last episode was watched by 25 million. And this was pre-streaming, really pre-streaming. 2019, but still pretty much pre-streaming. Tell us about NASA.
Right.
Tell us how, this is all in the book, by the way. It's all super cool. It's nuanced, it's micro, it's macro, and it's fun. All right. This is how you select the perfect NASA astronaut.
Right. Okay. So it relates to this Big Bang Theory. So NASA has a kind of similar problem, which is in the 1980s, they need to start finding astronauts who are emotionally intelligent because they're about to start spending people up into space for 6 months or a year. Now, the problem is if you make it to the final rounds of a NASA interview, you're awesome, right? You're like, you have the right stuff. You look amazing. You can fake emotional intelligence as well as anyone on Earth.
Uh-oh.
So the psychologists interviewing all these candidates, they couldn't tell the difference between people who actually had emotional intelligence and people who are faking it really well. But after 3 months in space, the people who are faking it, they're going to be freaking out and falling apart. Yes, they're going to run out of rope.
Yeah.
So the psychologist comes up with a new test. He starts walking into the interview room carrying a stack of papers, and he spills the papers as if on accident when he walks in. And then he would laugh this huge laugh like, I'm such a klutz. And then he would pay attention to how the astronaut candidate reacted. Because everyone would laugh back, because that's just social politeness. But some of them would go like this. Yeah, it's funny. Here, let me give you a hand. And other candidates would go, that is really funny. Let me give you a hand. The people who matched his energy level, they were showing him that they want to connect with him. They were the ones who had emotional intelligence. And actually, we all do this all the time. 80% of the time when we laugh, it's not in response to anything funny. We laugh during a conversation to show the other person we want to connect with them, yeah. And they laugh back to show that they want to connect with us.
It's interesting. And the thing about the matching is you can fake it if you like, but actually, if you are going to try and fake it, you'll probably be just a bit under or just a bit over or a lot under or a lot over.
Exactly.
Whereas if you were genuinely sort of the beach to other people's waves, then you will reflect it almost perfectly.
That's exactly right. Authenticity is so easy for us. And when we are inauthentic, the smallest little inauthenticity, our brains are designed to detect almost immediately.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, again, you talk about in The Power of Habits, but, you know, it's about the energy behind the action. And it's about habit energy sometimes as well, isn't it? And you can have an energy of authenticity.
Absolutely.
Which is what you talk about a lot.
Absolutely. And there's this thing that happens. Every human has evolved to engage in what's known as emotional reciprocity and authenticity reciprocity, which says when we see someone being honest with us, being authentic, being vulnerable, expressing an emotion, we can't help but not listen to them. That is the loudest form of communication. And we have this instinct to do the same thing right back, to be authentic back, to be vulnerable back. In fact, that's how Homo sapiens became the species that we are, yeah, right? That's how we built families and villages and towns. Yeah. This capacity for reciprocity, particularly through conversation, is strong. And if we learn the right skills to let those instincts work,
yeah,
then we're off to the races.
And linguistics are interesting, aren't they? Because we talk about the human species a lot on this show about as being different because of three things: imagination, memory, and language.
Yeah.
Vocal language, that is. And vocal language, of course, is a superpower up until a point. But it's, in a way, it's like having loads of screws, but not really having the best hammering action. You can mess it all up easily as you can try and achieve something. And if people use books like yours, and you talk about this a lot, for leverage of a more nefarious kind, they will eventually come a cropper.
Oh, yeah. No, and absolutely. There's one of my favorite studies showing this. So these researchers found a bunch of friends and they tape recorded them laughing together, like genuine laughter. And then they found a bunch of strangers and they told them to laugh together and they tape recorded that too. And then they would cut the tape down to 1 second clips.
Yeah.
And they would play it for people. And listeners could tell with 90% accuracy who was friends and who were strangers. Mm. And that's because evolutionarily, our brain had to be on high alert for inauthenticity. If a con man comes into our village, he could kill all of us.
Yeah.
So we're very attuned to something that's inauthentic. Mm-hmm. And as a result, in that conversation, we've all had this, right? Someone asks us where we went on vacation and like we know immediately, oh, you asked me because you want me to ask you so you can brag about where you just went on vacation.
Yeah.
Right? We know this. We feel this inauthenticity. And you're right. It has to be vulnerable. It has to be genuine.
So this whole thing about the X factor, you know, this show, the X factor, and we talk about people with the X factor, and we talk about chemistry, and it's that elusive thing. It's the opposite. It's an obvious thing because we are so brilliant at detecting it.
Yeah.
There's nothing X or X-Filesy or mysterious about it. I mean, it's brilliant for a TV show and the X Factor does work, but it's not because it's something in the distance that you've got to get you have to gain access to the Hubble telescope to spot. We're all sitting on our sofas at home going, they've got it.
Yep.
They've got it. It's not that difficult to spot. It's just, it might be indefinable, but it's eminently spottable.
And I think part of it is that in real life or when we're watching the show, we're asking questions. And when we shout questions at the screen, they can't answer back, but luckily the host asks some questions. But when we're doing it with each other, what super communicators do is they ask questions, 10 to 20 times as many questions as the average person.
Okay, this is very much important to the book, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And some of those questions are just questions to invite you in. They're things like, oh, what'd you say next? Or what happened then? Yeah. Like just these things you don't even register as questions, but some of them are what are known as deep questions.
Tell us the book is fantastic, by the way, and we're just scratching the surface. So we're talking about Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg, and Charles is with us now, Pulitzer Prize winning Charles Duhigg, an amazing author, an amazing thinker.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Craving some great 80s music? Play Virgin Radio 80s Plus. On DAB digital radio, on the app, on your smart speaker, and at virginradio80splus.co.uk.
I got my mind set on you.
Even if we're just dancing in the dark.
Love Chris Evans.
Woo!
Love the 80s.
Virgin Radio
80s Plus.
You talk in the book a lot about turning shallow questions into deep questions.
Yeah.
So instead of asking, where do you live, you would ask,
what do you love about the place you live?
What do you love? And that reveals more.
That reveals so much more. If what we know is that if you ask about the facts of someone's life, it's usually a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask how someone feels about their life, then oftentimes you give them a chance to tell you who they really are, right? One of my favorite examples is I bumped into a doctor, and instead of saying, like, where do you practice medicine? I said, what made you decide to go to medical school? You know, or what do you love? What do you love about your job? Like, what do you love about practicing medicine? Now, those don't seem like deep questions. Those don't seem intrusive or overly intimate. But this guy talked for the next 15 minutes. He told me all about seeing his dad get sick and deciding to go to medical school at that point. Like, I knew so much about this guy's values and beliefs and experiences after he – and I do the same thing with my kids. Instead of asking my, you know, do you guys have young children?
We have many children between
us. Yes. So
we have all the children.
you know that you come home, they come home from school and you're like, how was school? Good. Did you learn anything? No. What are you doing tomorrow? Nothing. But so what I've started doing is instead of asking about facts, I ask about feelings. I say like, you know, I saw you hung out with Jasper after school. Like, what do you admire about Jasper? What makes him such a good friend?
Yeah.
And then suddenly my kid's talking for like 15 minutes.
We need a list of those.
It's great.
Yeah. So Shelley question is becoming deep. This is from Charles' book. Where do you live becomes what do you like about what your neighborhood? Where do you work becomes what was your favorite job? Where did you go to college becomes what was the best part of college? Are you married becomes tell me about your family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are sort of creeping steps, micro steps towards small feelings becoming bigger feelings. I know you've talked a lot extensively, both this time around and the last couple of times around, about the science of small steps.
Yeah.
You know, small talk, which some people abhor, don't write it off, because small talk leads to big talk. Small questions lead to big answers.
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're exactly right. It's the science of small steps and the science of small wins. That oftentimes it's hard to jump into the deep end, right, in a conversation. You meet someone in a pub. You've never met them before. You don't want your first question to be like, when's the last time you cried in front of another person?
Yeah, because they're closed down.
Yeah. It's just too much. But if your goal with those smaller questions is to get into deeper questions and to invite them, not force them to, but invite them to, and if you say something vulnerable about yourself and you make it okay for them to say something vulnerable, mm-hmm. within minutes, you are having a real conversation. But people don't, because they feel anxious. The scariest thing in surveys, if you ask people to do, is having a conversation with a stranger until they have that conversation. And afterwards, if you ask them how it went, they say, oh, it's great.
So as far as people listening now, can you give them, you know, at 20 to 10 on a Tuesday morning, Tuesday the 5th of March, 2024, Charles Duhigg on the show, can you give us 3, 4, 5 tools that they can take
Absolutely.
With them today?
Absolutely. Okay, so the first one is ask more questions. Yep. Try and ask a deep question. When you bump into someone, a mate or your kids, instead of asking them about the facts of their day, ask them some version of how you felt about your day. Okay. What did you like? You know, what was the best part? That's number one. Number two, when they answer, prove to them that you're listening. Ask a follow-up question that shows that you're paying attention. If it's a tough conversation, repeat back what they said to you in your own words.
So your interpretation of what they said.
Exactly. And ask if you got it right. Right. I want to prove to you that I'm listening, because you might think that I'm just waiting for my turn to speak.
Right.
So I want to prove that I'm listening.
And there are little prefixes that are useful there. So tell me if I've got this right, or tell me if I've got this wrong.
Exactly. Or... exactly. What I hear you saying is, and tell me if this is right. It's easy to say, right? Okay, it becomes a habit.
And also it engages them just before you're saying, you're going to say what you're about to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now they're listening to me because they know that I'm listening so closely to them.
Which they like.
Which they love, right?
Because you've just unofficially become a fan of theirs.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. They're smart. I want to learn from them.
Cool. What else?
And then the third one I would say is, when somebody says something that indicates that they're in an emotional mindset, that they're feeling vulnerable, mirror that. Or if they're feeling high and they're feeling they would laugh, mirror that. Match their behavior. And one of my favorite examples of this is, everyone's had this experience. You're sitting down for a meeting, waiting for the meeting to start. You turn to the guy next to you and you say, how was your weekend? And he says, oh, it was great. My son graduated this weekend. I went to graduation. And most of the time we just say, oh, congratulations. Okay, now let's get down to the agenda.
Yeah.
But if you take 30 seconds and you say, congratulations. What did it feel like to watch your kid walk across that stage?
Oh,
like, did it feel amazing?
That's a good question.
It's a great question. And you know what? At that point, because this guy, it's what he's thinking about, right?
See, that's why you're a ninja. Because I would have said now, trying to impress you in this conversation, I would say, yeah, because the next thing you need to say is, oh, really? What did he graduate in? But what you've done is you've skipped that and gone to, how did this guy feel about it?
How did
so you've switched him on.
And you're not forcing him to, but you're inviting him to say, I was so proud, or it made me think about when I graduated and how much my dad loved me, or it made me anxious about the future because I don't know if there's a job for him. Now he's talking about things that matter. And then if you reciprocate and you say, you know, I don't have any kids, none of them have graduated from college, but I do have some nephews and they're only 7, but I have that same kind of anxiety. I totally know what you mean. Now we have a connection.
You've got to be careful there, though, because you can steal that conversation.
Right. You don't want to steal the spotlight.
So give us an example of stealing.
So the stealing is like, you know, you're, and we've all seen this. You're talking to someone and how are you? Oh, my aunt passed away this weekend. And someone says, I know what that's like. You know, I had a pet that died 7 years ago, yeah, and it's really hard.
Hang on, it's my grief. We're talking about my grief, not your grief.
We don't want to talk about you now.
Yeah, shut up.
But sometimes the way that we show vulnerability is we just ask questions and we just say, oh, your aunt, I'm so sorry. Tell me about your aunt. What was she like?
Yeah.
Like, what did she mean to you? Yeah. That's a way of matching.
Would you say you're now a super communicating ninja or Jedi? Do you want to go ninja or Jedi?
I would say,
Charles,
I'm a Padawan.
I'm an amateur.
This is the thing that all super communicators have in common. They think about communication and they think about where they fail at it. So right. If you talk to people who are consistent super communicators, and all of us are super communicators at some point, but there are people who can do this consistently. They can connect with anyone. And you ask them about their past, they'll say things like, when I was in high school, I had real trouble making friends.
Yes.
So I had to study how other kids talk to each other. My parents got divorced and I had to be the peacemaker between them. It's thinking about conversation, thinking about communication that makes us better at it. It's showing the other person we want to connect with them that allows us to connect. That's the power of this. Anyone who is a ninja, they're probably less good of a communicator than the person who says, I'm a Padawan. I have things to learn every single day.
Yeah.
And I want to think about it.
We can say that about people. We can say, they just can't say it about themselves, though.
Yes, exactly.
Where does super communicating feature as an ingredient to our reason for being here, to our survival instincts? You know, where does it benefit us? Where does it benefit our species?
Oh, it enormously. Communication is Homo sapiens' superpower.
Right.
It is the thing that is why we live in a human-dominated world, right? No other animal can communicate the way that we can. And what it meant is that when we were eons ago evolving, that the people who could communicate better, they could form a little tribe.
Yeah.
And when that tribe got attacked by individuals, they could defend themselves.
You literally survive.
You literally survive. You take care of your offspring. If someone gets a little bit older, you take care of them until they get healthy again. And more importantly, our brains evolve to crave this connection,
yeah,
because that connection helps us survive. So all of us are carrying around in our head the hardware to want to connect with each other, to be able to connect with each other, and to feel wonderful. That feeling you get after a great conversation, that's a real feeling. That's because your brain wants you to connect with other people. And what we know is if you do, you will live, even today, you will live longer, you will be happier, you will be more successful, however you define it. A big study was done trying to figure out what made people healthier at age 65 and happier. And the only answer they found was having a handful of close relationships at age 45.
Community. We had the guys who are still in charge of that study,
yeah,
on the show, the two,
yeah,
geniuses. It's funny, isn't it? Because communication and conversation, whether it's, you know, vocal, via email, via text, via WhatsApp, psychological, almost telepathic sometimes, it's so important to us. Even people who spend all day calling talk radio stations to argue with other people do it as part of a weird community.
Yeah.
So conflict can also be community.
Oh,
we're
absolutely
the guys that argue with each other all day. Yeah, but we, you know, but we're regulars and and we're there for each other at the end of the day. You may be a blue, I may be red. We may fight till almost the death, but we're never going to kill each other. Because that's how we are.
I mean, that's how we've always been.
So funny, man.
Think about the things we love most about our nations, right? America was born in people arguing with each other. The major moments in British history are when Parliament rose up, or when the upper classes rose up. These people all hated each other.
Yeah.
They all hated each other. They all came together and they argued. Or if I look out on your streets today, yeah, and I look at what's going on with the debates today, the reason this country is so strong, the reason it's such a strong democracy, is because people know how to argue with each other,
yeah,
without killing each other.
Yeah, just about. Thank God. Right. At least it gets on to Trump, because back in your homeland, it's Super Tuesday today. It's,
yes,
a big, big day.
Yeah.
Now, love him or hate him, you can't say he's not a super communicator. However, he's not a great listener. And we know from your book that one of the attributes of being a super communicator is being a super listener. So how come he's cutting through when he's really no need for ears?
So what's really interesting, so I've spent some time with Trump.
Have you actually?
He actually is he listens so acutely. Now, what's different is, it's all about him. He's listening to figure out how he can impress you, how he can use what you are saying against you, how he's a narcissist, right? But he listens really, really carefully. And if you look at him in front of his crowds, the reason he's so popular right now is he is listening to what his crowds are telling him. They're saying, we hate this and we hate that. And he says it right back. Right. I hate this and
so
I hate
matching.
That.
He's super matching.
He's super matching. And that's the thing is that, you know, look, these are tools. Much like an axe is a tool. You can use an axe to build a house. You can also use an axe to chop someone's head off.
Interesting.
These are tools that we have to understand how to use. And some people use them for their own benefit in ways that are troubling.
So Rishi Sunak, who's our current prime minister, probably not for much longer, according to everybody, even, including probably even himself, but definitely his own party. You know, I think we all agree that he's not shy of a very heavy lifting work day. You know, he's happy to work hard. He's brilliant at reading spreadsheets. I've met him a few times. He seems like an extremely nice person. I could be wrong, but he's just not a great politician. If you could give our prime minister some tips today, what might you say to him?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you feel like he listens to you and your friends? You're not in one-on-one conversation, but the things that you care about, is he proving to you that he hears what you care about?
I think he's so surrounded by so many disparate voices within his party at the moment. I think he can probably only hear chaos, white noise, if you like.
Right.
And he's trying. High noise, low signal.
Yes.
Kind of world.
Yes, and that's terrible, right? Because if you're telling me something, and I need to prove to you that I'm hearing you. The goal is not to tell you all the extraneous stuff. The goal is to say, here's at the core of what I hear you saying. Tell me if I'm getting this right.
Right. And that's what Trump does brilliantly.
That's what Trump does brilliantly. Yeah. He gets right to the core. Now, it's a terrible core, but he gets right to that core. And I think in my opinion, some of my countrymen would disagree with me. But I do think that really good politicians, they make you feel heard. They make you feel heard.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you think to yourself, I could speak till I'm blue in the face and this guy is not going to hear what I'm saying.
So many more stories in this book. It's so brilliant, this book. You're a really good storyteller. Storytelling is really important. Of course it is in being a super communicator. You start a lot of the sections of this book off with examples of a story. Then you go away from it and you come back to it. It's very Cain and Abel, very brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning kind of copywriting. It's a great story about a spy. Can you give us the spy recruiting story in a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. So this guy is sent over from the CIA to recruit spies in Europe, and he's terrible at it. He's the worst. People in parties say things like, I know you're trying to recruit me. I will report you to the authorities, and you will get deported.
Or killed.
So eventually he meets this young woman from the Middle East, and he just kind of gives up. And he's like, look, I'm not even going to try and recruit you because I'm so bad at this job. I'm about to get fired. I've wanted this forever and I'm terrible at it. And when he says that, she looks over at him, starts crying and says, no, I can help you. Like, I feel the same way about my own life.
Okay, I'll do it.
Exactly.
I'll be a spy. All right, then.
She becomes the best asset in the Middle East over the next 20 years. But the only reason why was because this guy was authentic and honest with her instead of trying to sell her on something.
So you say conversations are really about three things. What are the three things conversations are about?
So the conversations are these practical conversations when we're talking about what's this really about. We're trying to figure out what we both want out of this conversation.
And you can decide that, or you can have an idea of what that is before you even enter the building.
Absolutely.
What's this probably about?
And I think that sometimes, you know, we're here to talk about the book, but also because what I want out of this conversation is I want to get to know you guys. You guys seem like really interesting guys and have a good time.
And we want to like each other and we want each other to like the other.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And that's kind of practical.
Because we're all a little bit Trump.
Exactly. But it feels better when we put it on the table when we talk about
it's
it,
funny,
right?
Funny, man.
Yeah.
What else?
The second conversation is an emotional conversation.
Yeah.
In the emotional conversation, I want you to understand how I'm feeling. And I want to understand how you're feeling, but not solve each other's feelings. Not come in and say like, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. I'm going to make it better for you. Because what I'm feeling is important to me and I want you to know it. Mm. And then the third kind of conversation is the social conversation, which is a conversation about our similarities and our differences. That if you are, you know, if you're Jewish and I'm Palestinian, if you're black and I'm white, if you're a man and I'm a woman, we have so much in common, but there's also these things that we see differently. And being able to bring our full self to a conversation means being able to say, here's how I see something differently from you.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. It's important to knowing each other.
Yeah. So if we have two buckets, let's have four buckets, right? So we have two small buckets that you make sandcastles with, and then we have huge industrial buckets. And we're sitting opposite sides of the table. And in the industrial buckets is all the things we have in common. So let's put those two on the table. And then these little seaside buckets, this is our differences. So if you just put that out there physically, visually, straight away you go, well, we're basically on the same page. So we don't need to worry about that.
Right.
Let's just have a chat about this.
Right. But think
but
about...
But this isn't that.
No, and think about how frequently we come to the dinner table with like our crazy relatives, or we're walking down through some protest, and we forget that that big bucket exists, yeah. Right? We forget that we're both Britons, or we're both Americans, or we're family members.
Yeah. Both alive.
We're both alive. We both care about our kids. Yeah, yeah. Instead, we focus on this little bucket as if it's the only bucket that exists. And the truth of the matter is, until you acknowledge the big bucket, it's really hard to talk about the little bucket.
Zooming out helps oftentimes.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Because when I zoom out, usually what I'm saying to you is... We might disagree about something, but I want to understand you.
Yeah, look at where we live. Look at the sky.
Yeah.
Look at the blue skies. Smell the roses.
I want to listen to you. I want us to both find joy in something together.
We've run out of time. Sorry, we're way out of time. Sorry you two didn't get a look in. I do apologize. I was engaged, fully engaged there. I was locked on. Sorry about that.
All good.
All good. Charles Duhigg. You're great, Charles.
Thank you so much for having me. You guys are super communicators. I'm a huge fan of the show.
Are you actually?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection with Charles Duhigg. It's out now. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's amazing. We're out of time. Have a great Tuesday. We'll see you Wednesday. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.